This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, another wave of bank earnings with Citigroup, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs all reporting. I'm Bob Moon in New York. I'll have that story.
I'm Nathan Hager in Washington, a city waiting to see more of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia report. The Attorney General has promised it this week.
And I'm Naira Chahich in London, where we look to Ukraine's election runoff, which pits a comedian who plays the president on TV against the country's actual president.
I'm Danielle Bokov in Toronto. If Alberta were a country, it would make the top 10 list of global oil producers and the top 5 compared to OPEC. We're looking at a pivotal election for the Canadian province.
And in Asia, a slew of economic data coming in China. Does it confirm that the bottom is in? I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with bank earnings. Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and Bank of America all reporting this week. For more, we're joined by Allison Williams, Senior Financial Services Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, and Bloomberg Investment Banking Reporter, Sonali Basak. And Allison, let me start with you. What do the J.P. Morgan earnings tell us about what might be ahead?
J.P. Morgan earnings haven't really changed our view too much. So the capital markets revenue did come in better than expected, but still down a lot. And April is a constructive month, so that's a key positive, but we are early in the quarter.
Allison, let's take next week in chronological order. On Monday, we get Goldman and Citigroup. Let's start with Goldman. What's the outlook?
So the numbers from J.P. Morgan generally bode well for Goldman, but for that particular bank, I think the key is really going to be what are the relative trends in their trading business, because they had a tough 2017. There were some concerns around market share. 2018, they had a pretty strong rebound. Sometimes it's due to mix, but also I think investors are just going to want to see that the bank is executing on its strategy to do better with certain types of clients, and that they are gaining overall share of wallet.
Sonali, how do things look just for investment banking in general right now?
So we're in a year where there are some very large IPOs coming, so there might be better equity capital markets revenue moving forward. It was pretty weak so far at J.P. Morgan this quarter, so that's pretty good. Debt capital markets is also better. Advisory fees might be pretty strong also. There was just a $33 billion deal announced this week. And so we could expect better results for investment banking. The question is how long that will be sustained, given investment banking is really largely tied to how investors feel about the market.
And Allison, let's move on to Citigroup.
For Citigroup, again, the positive trading numbers from J.P. Morgan, the constructive environment in April should both be good for Citigroup, especially we did see some lift in currency trading in some of the numbers towards the end of March. That's an important business for Citigroup, so we're going to want to hear more from them, you know, especially if they are seeing some follow-through in this quarter. M&A fees is an area of strength that we're expecting from Citigroup. Again, we're going to want to hear about the pipeline and client sentiment, if that can continue on. Debt capital market fees are really positive at J.P. Morgan. We'll expect to see the same from Citigroup and from Bank of America. However, our credit strategist, Noel Hebert, has sort of a more bearish view on underwriting for the year. So we're going to, again, want to hear about the pipeline and the outlook for that business.
And take the bigger picture, if you will, Allison, on Bank of America.
So for Bank of America, one of the more negative data points that we had came from Wells Fargo, and that was the lowering of their net interest income guidance, expecting a 2-5% drop in that type of revenue for the year. The previous consensus expectation going into this quarter was an increase of 1%. And the shape of the yield curve is something investors have been watching. Rising deposit costs are a concern. And both of those factors play into Wells lowering their guidance. The other issue for them is lower reinvestment rates for a portfolio that they invest in. These are all factors that could affect Bank of America. J.P. Morgan did not change their guidance, but also did note if the shape of the current yield curve sustains, that could be a negative. So Bank of America's insights and their projections on net interest income in light of all this is going to be important.
Well, since you bring up yield curve, how much concern is there still out there, Sonali, on the yield curve?
I think Allison just hit it on the nail, right? JP Morgan was able to show that they're able to sustain results despite what the yield curve looks like right now and despite a pause in rate hikes. However, Wells Fargo, the outlook is not as pretty. So for Bank of America, I think it'll be a very big tell on kind of how the banks will be impacted more largely, especially regionals as well. In terms of earnings next week, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs are much more highly weighted in investment banking and trading, and so they may weather kind of this yield curve skittishness a little better.
And Allison, we have now covered Tuesday and Bank of America, so let's move on to Wednesday and Morgan Stanley.
So Morgan Stanley, what will be interesting to see if we can get the trading snack back. So this is a business that's still important for Morgan Stanley, even though they've emphasized the wealth business, and that's an increasing share of their revenue. Trading continues to be a core part of their revenue, especially the equity trading. They're the leader in that business. That's the business that has the really tough comparisons to a strong year ago. So that's sort of baked into estimates for a decline. Morgan Stanley missed last quarter. All the banks generally missed, but that was sort of a first for them because they've generally meet or beat for several quarters in a row. So I think, you know, again, the overall trend is important, but what is the share of wallet and will we see some snapback in their results?
Our thanks to Bloomberg Investment Banking reporter Sonali Basak and Allison Williams, Senior Financial Services Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. We will have much more on other big earnings in the coming week, like Netflix, a little later in the program. But up next on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, a look at when the Mueller report will be released. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Time to head to the nation's capital, where Attorney General William Barr has promised to release the full version of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on the Russian election interference, minus redactions, this week. For more, Bloomberg Daybreak anchor Nathan Hager joins us from our 99.1 newsroom in Washington. Nathan.
Well, Bob, Barr did tell a Senate Appropriations panel this past week his original timetable still stands, and even if the full unedited report doesn't see the light of day, that doesn't mean members of Congress will be kept in the dark.
The fact that information is classified does not doesn't mean that Congress can't see it. So I'm willing to work on some of these categories.
And Bloomberg Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gordon is with me now. Of course, Craig, this is the report that so much of Washington has been waiting for. Do we have a sense at this point how much of the report we could see from Attorney General Barr?
You know, it's interesting. We don't have a clear picture of that. We know that Barr has told us there are four categories of information that will be left out. Some of that is grand jury testimony, classified information, information about sort of peripheral characters that aren't that central to it, and then information about ongoing investigations that are, you know, still in the offing. So if it's a 300-some-odd page report and you've got four pretty big categories like that, it's hard to know how much we'll actually see. I actually think one of the things to watch in this and the public, you know, we journalists are used to seeing redacted information. Sure. You file a Freedom of Information request, you get 10 pages back. 9 pages are a big black block. Mm-hmm. 1 page is you see a few words here and there. And I think people are going to be surprised at what the kind of the Swiss cheese nature of this and what little they can see versus what more they can't.
Because there are all these questions that have been surrounding this report ever since Attorney General Barr put out that 4-page summary that the president has said exonerates him completely when it comes to obstruction of justice and the question of collusion. But behind the scenes, we're hearing reports from a number of members of Special Counsel Mueller's team that maybe that summary was perhaps more favorable to the president than the Mueller report itself.
So, look, the central thing that we journalists here at Bloomberg are going to be looking at is the very question of obstruction. It does seem like Mueller made a fairly definitive conclusion that there was no collusion between Donald Trump's campaign and the Russian government, despite many efforts by the Russian government to make that happen. So that in Barr's letter, that was laid out in a pretty definitive way. The question of obstruction of justice, people may remember from the Barr letter, was Mueller said, I could not find any way to criminally charge the president with obstruction, but nor did I exonerate him. There's that word exonerate again. So that is really the first thing we're going to be looking at when we actually get to see this. Mueller obviously found something that he felt looked like, smelled like, felt like obstruction, but perhaps not enough to meet the legal requirement to bring a criminal charge of obstruction. And people, again, may remember to have obstruction of justice, you have to have intent. You have to have meant to obstruct it, meant to end the investigation, meant to steer it off course. A lot of Democrats say Donald Trump said himself he fired James Comey because he didn't like the Russia investigation, but Mueller apparently concluded that wasn't enough. And I think it's fair to say we're all hoping what we see in this report will answer that one central mystery of the Mueller report.
Thank you, Craig.
Of course.
That's Bloomberg Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gordon, and that's what's happening in the nation's capital. I'm Nathan Hager. You can follow all developments in Washington by tuning into Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law. It airs weekdays at noon, Wall Street time, on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Thanks, Nathan. Now we turn to the political situation in Europe, where a key election is being held. For more, let's turn things over to Daybreak Europe anchor Neighbor Chayich.
Yes, Bob. 5 years after deadly street protests toppled Ukraine's Kremlin-backed leader, voters have begun to offer their verdict on what's happened since. A first round of presidential elections has left President Petro Poroshenko facing an April 21st runoff against the country's most watched comedian, Volodymyr Zelensky. For more on the changing political landscape in Eastern Europe, I'm joined by Bloomberg's Kiev bureau chief, Darina Krasnolutska, and Andrew Langley, Bloomberg's editor on the Eastern European team. Let's start with Darina. Darina, how has a popular comedian with no political experience turned into the leading presidential candidate in just 3 months?
Actually, Volodymyr Zelensky announced his bid for the presidency on New Year Eve. And since then, you're exactly right, his rating jumped. His popularity is largely down to his lack of political baggage. And he also surrounded himself with the very well-known reformists. Basically, the comic has taken aim at the incumbent leader over graft. When people protested back in 2014, the one thing they wanted, just meaningful steps in fighting corruption. But unfortunately, under Poroshenko's leadership, the current president's leadership, no significant steps has been done, and none of officials has been convicted. However, corruption scandals that also involved the current president, allies, and friends, they were widely reported in local media and by activists. So Zelensky is actually very popular because people mainly vote against the current leadership. And he is just a leader of this anti-establishment movement.
Yes. And on that note, Andrew, is Zelensky a typical populist candidate?
He displays some of the elements that we're familiar with already from other populists in Europe. He is, first and foremost, as Darina said, he is anti-establishment. But when you look a little bit more at some of the things he's been saying, he's been quite vague on many of his policies, but the general direction of what he wants to do appears to be maintaining Ukraine's pro-European course, pro-Western course, maintaining its cooperation with the International Monetary Fund, which is backing up the economy at the moment with billions of dollars of aid. So he is, on one hand, he's anti-establishment, anti-elite, but on the other, he is much more mainstream, maybe, than some of the other more traditional populists in the wider Eastern European region, like in Hungary and in Poland.
Interesting. Darina, what can we expect from Zelensky if he wins?
That's a very good question, which investors, not only investors, but local voters are puzzled very much. As Andrew said, he's very vague in his policies, like, for example, economy policy. The only clear thing from him is that Ukraine will continue its path toward rest, and that's what people largely support here. And he also stated that he's committed to cooperation with the International Monetary Fund, which is the key Ukraine's creditor. So that's all we can say from his policies. And he also campaigns a lot on the anti-corruption. He promises to put in jail all crooked officials,
yep.
And he promises to appoint clean and very professional people to run the law enforcement forces.
Great to have you both with me. Andrew Langley, Bloomberg's editor on the Eastern European team, and Darina Krasnolutska, Bloomberg's Kiev bureau chief. Thank you both. I'm Neira Chahich in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Neera. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, key readings on the Chinese economy in the week ahead. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. A look ahead to earnings from Netflix. But first we head to Asia, where investors await some key data on the Chinese economy. For more, let's hand things over to Bloomberg Daybreak Asia anchors Doug Krisner and Brian Curtis.
Bob, a big question looms on the Chinese economy. Does March serve as a turning point, and is the bottom finally in? A slew of data coming in the next few days that will clarify the picture. Doug and I thought we'd reach out to Bloomberg's Jeff Black. He's the team leader of Greater China Economics. So, Jeff, what is your team expecting these numbers to actually say?
Our best guess right now is that the stabilization in the data that we've been seeing throughout the first quarter will continue. So this is backward-looking, of course. We're going to get GDP data for the first quarter next week. We get retail sales, we get industrial production, we get investment. So we really get a big dump of data that gives us actual hard numbers on the first quarter. And the outlook is that the slowdown will continue, but at a pretty moderate pace. And there are signs that stimulus is kicking in. That will be a better sign for the rest of the year. So indeed, the bottom could be in. It would be a pretty bad surprise if it came out worse than that.
Yeah, stimulus in the way of tax cuts on the fiscal side, and we know that there's been a little bit of adjustment on the monetary policy side as well. But I'm wondering about the retail sales figure in particular, because when we think of China, we think of the transformation, the growing middle class, and a more domestically driven economy. I mean, is this going to, you think, be a leading indicator, the retail sales number, a leading indicator of any recovery that we may be seeing more broadly?
We won't be able to see into the future with that number, but it is pretty key. You've put your finger on it there. And retail sales have been slowing to record lows in the past few months. What really helps to turn it around? Well, tax cuts that came through last year should really now begin to actually make people start to feel a little bit better off, and that can feed through then into spending habits. Things like car sales need to start to turn around in order for that number to sustainably pick up. And then there's just the confidence effect. If you get better news, if you start hearing better news on the economy, you start hearing better news on the property market, which there's also better signs there.
Yes.
And you start hearing better news on the trade deal front, i.e. you think that we're not going to descend into chaos on that front, then on balance, households might be a little bit more relaxed.
Inflation turned around after falling for quite a long time, but that may have been skewed a bit by a big jump in pork prices.
Right.
But in any case, is it likely that PBOC starts to rethink its position, or is it just that maybe it heads off what might have been a cut?
So on the current data, including the most recent, which showed that surge in CPI, it's unlikely that that will actually change the central bank stance. They're trying to do a fairly tricky balance between keeping liquidity ample but not too loose, just trying to keep a floor on things.
I'm wondering whether or not we might see something in the industrial output data to kind of confirm the uptick in the PMI.
Well, that's entirely possible. We are looking at the same period, so there may be something of a lag in there. However, the encouraging thing about that PMI data was that the improvement wasn't just in the main index or driven by a couple of sub-indices. It was really across the board. So that signals that even foreign trade is not collapsing or orders for foreign trade, and the domestic components of that are also improving. So that PMI report, you know, it's not grounds for champagne corks, but it was fairly encouraging all round.
Property seems pretty important in China. Does that have the potential to be a game changer for the economy?
I think so. Property obviously touches everything, right? From the demand for construction materials to refrigerators and even cars and things like that are linked to property, property prices, and how confident people feel about their investment in the home that they live in, just like anywhere else. Developers' projects have been picking up. The financing conditions are a little bit better. We've seen curbs loosened on a number of cities. Residency curbs have also been loosened a little bit. So this is a tricky balance because obviously they've been trying to slow the property market down for the longest time. So it's not exactly shackles off, but on balance, policymakers want to give a little bit of support there, and households should begin to feel that.
Jeff, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your insights. Bloomberg's Jeff Black there. He is the team leader for Greater China Economics. I'm Doug Krisner along with Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong, 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thank you, Doug and Brian. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, earnings season begins in earnest on Wall Street. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Earlier in the program, we took a look at bank earnings coming up this week, but there are other key reports for investors. For more, let's welcome Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Poncik and Bloomberg Stock Market columnist Dave Wilson. Sarah, let me start with you, and let me stay on bank earnings for just a moment. Overall, how do you think the market might react?
So interestingly enough, I've heard from a lot of investors saying that people might be underestimating the banks as we head into this earnings season because people have really been worried about the narrative of a flattening yield curve. What does that mean for profitability? But if you actually look at the breakdown, you look at banks, for example, earnings growth is expected to be pretty flat year over year compared with the broader S&P, which is expected to be down 4%. So relatively, if the expectations come true, it could be better than the rest of the market.
And Dave Wilson, what about you?
Well, I mean, one thing you can say for sure is that if you look at the banks, they haven't really recovered from what we saw last decade in the housing market's collapse. You know, the way that other groups have come back and set records, you know, along the way in this 10-year plus bull market that we've seen, you know, depending on how you count it. So, you know, there's certainly room for the banks to rise if you get the kind of favorable results that Sarah's talking about. And let's face it, I mean, we've seen numbers come down across the board for S&P 500 companies. You know, it's something on the order of 8 percentage points since the start of the year in terms of first quarter estimates. So there's a lot more room for companies like the banks to, shall we say, step over the bar when it comes to earnings.
We move along to the streaming juggernaut that is Netflix. And Sarah, what are we expecting there?
Well, Netflix has just been on a tear this year as it was last year as well. And of course, when it comes to Netflix, you're always going to want to keep an eye on subscriber growth. Are we seeing an increase there? At the same time, it could be potentially interesting to see if they say anything at all about competition, because we know just this last week, Disney had their investment yesterday, and they're really talking up Disney Plus streaming, and there are many analysts out there saying, you know what, this could actually really pose some competition to the likes of Netflix. So that could be something to keep an eye on or watch out for.
Dave Wilson, any concern really about subscriber growth for Netflix?
Well, I mean, it's there because they're spending so much money on programming. And with the idea of Disney going its own way as a competitor, you can understand that. I mean, that they have to be able to draw in more viewers and get people to pay the subscription fees, which in some cases are headed up. I can tell you, I got a message from Netflix the other day about my bill going up. It was like $1 a month. So, you know, they have to be able to justify that cost, especially as you get this proliferation of services. And ultimately, people have to decide what they're willing to spend their money on, just as they have over the years when it comes to cable systems. So, you know, that's the sort of thing Netflix is looking at. And, you know, we'll see how it played out in the first quarter and then what they are anticipating in terms of future growth may be very much front and center with investors.
IBM continues to find money in data. And what about their outlook?
As always, it's really about the cloud for IBM, and we're still awaiting some more details regarding the Red Hat acquisition. But what I can tell you is that recently, I mean, just as recently as a couple of days ago, Credit Suisse came out initiating coverage with a really positive rating on the stock. So what they're saying is that you look at this acquisition and they're actually pretty much positioned to be a big player in the hybrid cloud space. And you'll just have to pay attention to what executives are saying, how they continue to move forwards and really grab market share in the cloud space as well.
And they're going to need that kind of promise, because if you look at the analyst estimates that we've compiled, you got people anticipating that earnings will be down for a second straight quarter, that revenue will be down for a third straight quarter. So as much as anything, it's going to be a question of whether Red Hat can kind of revive IBM's business. Now, they've certainly, you know, tried to expand in the cloud and, you know, with Watson and artificial intelligence. It's only getting them so far. So the question is, how do they move forward? And, you know, Red Hat provides perhaps a way to do that.
And we also have some indicators on healthcare in the week ahead.
We do. So right away on Tuesday, we'll hear from Johnson & Johnson and United Health. And I'll start with United Health just because managed care providers have really been under a lot of pressure this year, especially as you turn to Washington, D.C., and everyone is talking about the potential Medicare for all. But interestingly enough, you look at the numbers, the expected numbers for United Health, and they're expected to see adjusted earnings growth of 18%, revenue growth of 8%. And really, you look at healthcare at large, interestingly enough, healthcare is supposed to see an earnings gain of 3% across the board in this quarter when the rest of the market is really supposed to be lower. We're supposed to see earnings growth decline. So healthcare is also one of those areas where we've really seen it beat up this year, but potentially we could see some positivity come out of this earnings season.
Now, as far as J&J goes, Johnson & Johnson is out the same day as United Healthcare, and the issue there is basically how are they managing their liabilities to some extent and managing to grow, because, you know, they've really got two issues to sort of front and center for them, the lawsuits over their talc baby powder and how it's supposedly causing people's cancers, and they're also tied into some of these opioid cases that have come up, you know, and they're dealing with that at the same time that they're trying to expand, especially in their pharmaceutical business. So, you know, that's going to be something to watch as we go forward.
And finally, Sarah, any life in the beverage and snacks business?
Last but not least, we've got Pepsi reporting on Wednesday. Pepsi could be an interesting one because the last time around, it was their new CEO's first earnings report. And Pepsi did come out. They gave a soft profit outlook for the full year. They actually said earnings could decline because they're seeing some weak economics. They're also seeing weaker consumer confidence, and they're also spending a lot more on marketing. But that time around, we actually saw shares get a boost. So we know that they're not expected to see earnings growth this year. They have warned about that, but it'll be interesting to see if the market does kind of give the new CEO a pass this time, if anything does go awry.
And Dave Wilson, your take on this?
Well, they have the challenge of being able to grow just as, you know, their biggest rival, Coca-Cola, does. And, you know, it's how they expand the business, you know, that they've shifted more toward, you know, the Frito-Lay side. And they just have to be able to find ways to grow. You know, what is it that's going to capture consumers' imagination, you know, especially in an era where, you know, the traditional colas just don't go down the way they used to,
so to speak. Our thanks to Bloomberg stock market columnist Dave Wilson and Bloomberg stocks reporter Sarah Poncik. Let's head to the commodity space now for the week ahead. For that, we bring in Bloomberg's Danielle Bokov in Toronto. Good day to you, Danielle.
Thanks, Bob. Alberta produces 3.7 million barrels of oil a day, which is roughly on par with the United Arab Emirates. If it were a country, it would make the top 10 list of global oil producers, and it is headed into an election that could result in a U-turn on policy. Bloomberg's Kevin Orland joins me from Calgary. Kevin, thanks for making some time.
Thanks for having me.
What are the key things that people outside Canada need to understand about this provincial election?
Well, the big thing about this provincial election is that it could be a return to conservative form for Alberta. This is a province that had been conservative for about 40 years before 2015, when a center-left government was ushered in. And all of the polls so far are showing that the Conservatives are going to take power back in the province. So it'll be a return to form for the province and also probably have some changes from the way that the current government has governed.
Kevin, what does that mean for environmental policy in the province and by extension, I guess, the rest of Canada as well?
Well, the leader of the United Conservative Party, Jason Kenney, is planning to take a much more combative style regarding energy and environmental policy. For a taste of that, here's a clip of him speaking at a rally in Calgary earlier this week.
The first act of a United Conservative cabinet will be proclaiming into law Bill 12, the turn off the taps legislation.
Yeah!
Yeah! If other provinces violate the Constitution and attack our vital economic interests, there will be real consequences.
So you can hear from that that he's planning to be much more combative in his relations with Ottawa and also with groups that are, against the Alberta energy industry. Aside from some of the legislation he's planning a lot of lawsuits, he's planning boycotts, and he's even planning a $30 million war room to fight back against anti-energy campaigns that are opposing the development of the oil sands.
Well, and meanwhile, this election coincides with a big meeting of petroleum producers who continue to be very concerned about the fact that Canadian crude trades at such a discount to WTI. How does the election potentially play into prices?
Well, that's been one of the big issues in this campaign. And that discount has persisted because there's a lack of pipeline space. So if the producers can't ship their oil to the U.S., it backs up in storage and the prices go down. So if the Conservatives are successful and their tactics work and more pipelines are built, that would definitely help Canadian heavy crude prices. More Canadian heavy crude getting to the U.S., that could crowd out imports from Saudi Arabia. It could further reduce OPEC's power. And it could also fill in for reduced shipments from Venezuela and Mexico. So it's changing power dynamics around the world. But the one X factor here is that the Conservatives have vowed to cancel the current government's plan to increase crude by rail capacity and invest money in doing that. So if they do follow through on that promise and cancel that plan, that could actually hurt Canadian crude prices. So we'll have to see, you know, what they actually do once they are in power.
Kevin, thank you very much. That's what we're watching this week in Commodities in Toronto. I'm Danielle Bokov.
Thanks, Danielle. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.